From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, emails show the back and forth between the Snyder administration and Enbridge Energy about what the state should do about Line 5.
We know that Valerie Brader, the former director of the energy agency, basically said, let us know if anything is misleading, which that caught a couple people's eyes as well.
The history of blue laws in Michigan guaranteeing no fun on Sunday.
It stated there won't be any games, any sports, any play, no public assembly.
She was a runner-up on The Voice, and that helped boost her singing career. Now Michigan's Lauren Dusky is back to sing for hometown crowds.
I look back, and I don't have any serious regrets, but I do wish I would have, believed in myself a little bit earlier on.
Plus baseball 1860s style. Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Later in the hour, the effects of cannabis on drivers and the difficulties in conducting roadside assessments. But first, has Governor Snyder's team partnered with Enbridge Energy in deciding the fate of Line 5? That's the question explored in a joint investigation by Bridge Magazine and the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. And before we dig into this, a reminder, Enbridge Energy is a corporate sponsor of Michigan Radio. Craig Mauger, executive director for the MCFN, and Jim Malowitz, the environment reporter for Bridge, co-authored this report, and they are with us now. Welcome to both of you.
Hey there.
Thanks.
So in 2 months of digging through more than 5,700 documents that you got through the Freedom of Information Act, you found a number of interwoven relationships between the Snyder administration and Enbridge. So I want to start where you start, which was the state's press release last November announcing an agreement between the Snyder administration and Enbridge. Jim, remind us just what the governor announced and what was in that agreement.
Sure. This was a pretty sweeping agreement that set up a series of studies for Enbridge to complete regarding the risks along Line 5 and some options for whether to swap it out or, address those risks. And it also required Enbridge to replace a segment of Line 5, which doesn't run just below the Straits of Mackinac. It also runs across a wide swath of Michigan. It required Enbridge to swap out a section below the St. Clair River. And so it was really setting the state on a path to ultimately decide the fate of the pipeline, which should be coming next month.
And I remember when we talked about this last fall, last November on Stateside, I remember that was the Governor Snyder's declaration, business as usual was not acceptable from Enbridge.
Correct, yeah. There have been some consternation about whether Enbridge was shielding information about the condition of Line 5 below the Straits, and a lot of statements of outrage against the company publicly for withholding that information.
So, Craig, who got a preview of the news release and state's talking points?
Yeah, according to the emails that we were able to obtain, it appears, of course, and you can check the emails out in the stores if you visit our websites online, it appears that one of the high-ranking state officials, quote, went over the press release with one of Enbridge's lobbyists before releasing it to the public. And also, the state provided a couple of Enbridge representatives with a copy of the talking points, with a question and answer document. So those are kind of internal documents that shaped how the state was going to spin this agreement. And they gave those to Enbridge in advance, and Enbridge kind of responded by giving the state some of its public relations talking points for when the agreement was announced. So there was definitely a collaboration on how this was going to be presented to the public.
In fact, in your story, there's an email from this official state energy director, Valerie Brader, to Enbridge lobbyist Deborah Muchmore, and we should point out, who is married to Governor Snyder's former chief of staff, Dennis Muchmore. And in the email, Brader says, if you see anything you think is incorrect or misleading, please let us know. Now, you spoke with people who have worked for the state in the past. What was their take on that, Craig?
Yeah, they basically, it was almost completely everyone was saying the same thing, that it is not unusual to give a regulated company a copy of a press release that may affect them in advance. That's not unusual. What would be unusual was it would be giving them a press release and then allowing them to provide feedback on areas that weren't simply relevant to facts. Like, this is factually incorrect, or this needs to be changed because it's just not right. The former DEQ employee said, you know, that would be kind of normal, but allowing anyone to say, well, I don't like the way you've worded this line and I don't like the way this sounds, that would be very unusual. And it's unclear at this point what kind of communication took place, other than we know that Valerie Brader, the former director of the energy agency, basically said, let us know if anything is misleading, which that caught a couple people's eyes as well.
Jim, what other examples can you tell us about that you found of state officials kind of letting people with direct ties to Enbridge have some input into state decisions about Line 5?
Sure. We had a combination of people with direct ties to Enbridge and lobbyists in general. I mean, you mentioned earlier that Enbridge's top lobbyist in the state is Deborah Muchmore, who is married to Snyder's former chief of staff. But also, we found some interesting things regarding Valerie Brader, who was the state's energy chief until earlier this year. She left that job to pursue a private sector job that advertises its services to energy companies who need consulting. And now the state has hired her back as a consultant on Line 5 and paying her $375 an hour. So that's another example that kind of stood out.
And there's several others I know that you look at a former advisory board, because certainly the Pipeline Safety Advisory Board has a role in state decisions, or is supposed to have a role in state decisions about Line 5. Guy Meadows, right, led a team through Michigan Tech. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so Guy Meadows is kind of the leader of this team that's led by Michigan Tech that is now going to be doing an analysis of risk involving Line 5. And when they made their proposal to get the contract to do this, they disclosed potential conflicts that involved doing a lot of projects for Enbridge previously, and they listed these as potential conflicts of interest. But in the proposal document, they stated that, you know, Guy Meadows basically stated that when he was appointed to the Pipeline Safety Board, the state knew about this and didn't see that it warranted him not being on the advisory board. So that was pretty interesting as well.
And to be clear, too, you know, our story isn't suggesting any untoward relationship between Meadows and the state. And he has said, you know, it's up for the public to decide whether there's a conflict there. And he was very open about it. But it's particularly interesting that the state knew that there had been some crossover between Meadows' projects with Enbridge and the state, because that contract was something the state signed after they nixed another contract with a firm that had disclosed partway through that they had done projects for Enbridge. And the state very loudly said that we don't want this conflict. So it was kind of replacing one contract with a potential conflict for another one.
So what about the Pipeline Safety Advisory Board? Did it have any role in that November 2017 agreement between Enbridge and the state? What'd you find out, Jim?
Yeah, that was a really interesting development that we kind of go into a little bit in the story, is that the Pipeline Safety Board was not happy. Some of its members were not happy that they didn't have a role in giving say or having input on this agreement that the state reached in November with Enbridge. So at least one of the board members we talked to was seemed pretty frustrated with the fact that the state had done all of this activity to share information with Enbridge, but hadn't shared any of this information with at least some members of the Pipeline Safety Advisory Board that is supposed to be there to, you know, advise the state on what to do about these pipelines. So that is a really fascinating element of this.
Now, in the emails that you dug through, did you find any case where Enbridge directly suggested the kinds of actions the state should take, Craig?
I mean, there were 5,000 emails. From the best of my knowledge, I saw no email that featured Enbridge telling the state, you need to do this, or you have to do this. I mean, suggestion is kind of a vague word. I think early on they might have suggested some things, but I didn't see anything that raised alarms in my mind, like Enbridge is dictating what's going to happen here. I did not see that. And I should say as well, the state is in a very tricky position with this. For one reason, Enbridge has access to all of this information regarding the pipeline, and they have the expertise on pipelines that maybe the state doesn't have. So they're often the state has to rely on Enbridge for certain elements of information. And in another way, this is tricky for the state because Enbridge has so many connections to so many people because it's such a large company that it is difficult to find people who aren't connected to them in one way or another.
Jim Malowitz, in your story, you spell out some actions that the state took to reduce conflicts of interest in decisions involving Line 5. What are those?
Well, one of the main ones is that in some of the studies that Enbridge had to complete, including looking at the viability of potentially putting a tunnel around a new section of Line 5 and swapping out the old one, the state paid a pair of outside experts to oversee that study. So the idea was, yes, Enbridge is doing this study, and a lot of people at the time when it was announced, you know, suggested is the study going to be fair and impartial? And the state is paying other folks to oversee that.
How did these folks respond to your reporting? Governor Snyder's office, the DEQ, Valerie Brader, the advisory board, there are many, many movable parts in this story. How did they react to this story?
Well, there are a lot of different elements to the story that are explored. So, I mean, different people responded in different ways. The DEQ answered the questions that we had to a certain extent. We sent them a list of questions, and they answered many of them. A couple of the questions they refused to answer and just gave maybe a one-word answer and didn't want to go into detail. Some of the things, some of the, you know, the lobbying firm that's been working for Enbridge, they provided some answers. I mean, I think for the most part, people answered the questions that we had to the best of their ability. The governor's office has directed a lot of the questions to the departments that are actually in charge of this, I would say.
And I would say the state's overall response is that they're basically echoing what they've said throughout this process. They're saying that we're the ones making the decisions, and we're trying to create a transparent process. And I guess it was our goal in reporting to give readers all of the information we had in regards to what might be going on behind the scenes.
And then, Jim, and just remind us what we watch for, what's coming up at the end of this summer.
Right. Governor Snyder has said that in August, he's going to make kind of a final determination on Line 5's fate. And it's looking like, and I know y'all have done reporting on this, that he likes the idea of replacing that section of Line 5 beneath the Straits with something that's protected in a tunnel buried maybe 100 feet below the lake bed, which will be a pretty expensive project that'll take years to complete. That's what Enbridge has said is feasible for the Straits. But we're going to find out for sure what Snyder wants to go with.
Craig Mauger and Jim Malowitz, their story, Emails Cast Out About Michigan's Ties to Enbridge in Line 5 Debate. It is a long read, certainly worth your time at bridgemi.com. Thank you so much to both of you for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And lots more to come right here on Stateside. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This weekend, baseball fans can roll back the clock way, way back, more than 150 years. There's a four-game tournament of early baseball happening at Cambridge Junction Historic State Park in Brooklyn. That's where the Walker Tavern Wheels will host an invitational with the Saginaw Old Golds, the Detroit Early Risers, and the Canton Corn Shuckers. Lori Perkins is site historian. Lori, we're talking about 1860s baseball, so the game was how old at that point?
Oh, practically brand new. It began during the Civil War. The Civil Union troops would play, you know, stick and ball, and it caught on after the war ended, and folks like that new baseball, and that's baseball with two words, not one.
Yeah, so we're saying baseball.
Ball,
so
yeah.
What are the big differences between this 1867 rural baseball that folks will see this Saturday and what we will see on the same day when the Tigers play the Houston Astros?
Ah, well, there are some similarities, but there are a lot of differences. The Wheels play a gentleman's game. They don't swear. They don't charge the batter. They don't get into spitting or sliding and wearing gloves. This game is played barehanded, so the ball will be retrieved just with the bare hands.
Ow.
cows, right? Yes.
What does the ball look like? Is the ball something, does it look like the kind of ball we would see the Tigers play with?
No, far different. The Tigers are playing with a hard surface leather ball, white. These folks will be playing with a leather ball that has slightly less interior core, and so it's a little softer to pick up with the hands. And so while they can hit it quite a distance, it's not going to hurt as much, I guess, when you pick it up without a glove.
And no sliding, huh?
No sliding, and no swearing, and no spitting. And if the conduct of the game is ungentlemanly, the captain of the team will be fined for breaking the rules.
Now, did I understand that really in the 1860s, the score didn't really matter the way it does today?
That's right. It was basically a gentleman's game, and it was not played for money but for civic pride. And, you know, people, they were trying to win the game, but they also knew that the stakes were not millions of dollars.
Now, how long would a 19th century baseball game typically last?
About a couple of hours. They still went the nine innings that the Tigers will do, but that usually takes about an hour and a half to 2 hours to play. It's played on grass. There's no baselines. They don't chalk out a diamond. The bags are made of cloth and filled with sand. They're not pinned down or anything like, you know, they're just like a sack, basically.
So by going around doing these tournaments and traveling, they're giving a lot of different fans a chance to see historic baseball.
Yes, right, yes. And the tournament is pretty big. The one we're having this weekend is hosted by the Wheels. The Wheels were champions in the league a couple of years back. They do take great pride in their winning seasons. And the distance traveled, I mean, Saginaw, Dearborn. We just hosted the Lottie Dawes for the first time here a couple of weeks ago. So Canton is another distance. So folks are driving a piece to participate in the games.
What is the feeling that you see these historic games bring for the crowds, for the folks sitting there? Is it like rolling the clock back in a cool way?
I think so, yeah. It's a very family-oriented game. We have our team here at the Wheels has about 100 fans, and they do follow them around. They go to Greenfield Village when the tournament is there. And it's not just family. It's local fans as well. But we have kids from babes in arms all the way up to 70-year-olds come out. They bring their lawn chairs. They bring a picnic. They sit in the shade and enjoy the park as well as play here.
Well, it sounds like a lot of fun. The Walker Tavern Wheels Baseball Invitational beginning Saturday, 9 a.m. at the Cambridge Junction Historic State Park in Brooklyn. And we've been talking to the site historian for Cambridge Junction, Lori Perkins. Lori, thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
You just never know when life has a great big surprise waiting just around the corner for you. Like when you're thinking it's time to put the music dream on the shelf and maybe go to dental school. And then you get a call from producers of The Voice asking you to audition for the TV singing competition. And that's how Gaylord's Lauren Dusky wound up with Blake Shelton as her coach, coming in second on the 2017 season of The Voice and getting a big, huge launch for her singing career.
The smile on your face lets me know that you need me. There's a truth in your eyes saying you'll never leave me. The touch of your hand says you'll catch me if ever I fall.
Lauren's first single is coming out this week, and she's back in Michigan for some performances on Thursday the 12th at the Intersection in Grand Rapids, and then home to Gaylord for Alpenfest this Friday the 13th. But she's with us now. Lauren Dusky, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. Hey, did you not climb up on stage and sing at Alpenfest when you were, what, 9 years old?
You know what? I kept saying nine, but my mom, I've been home for 3 weeks, she keeps telling me it was actually 7 years old, which is wild. It's all really coming full circle to be back on that stage this week, sharing my new music with my hometown in northern Michigan. It's such a treat for me to think back to that performance at 7 years old. And
when little Lauren was just fearless and, you know, had no idea what she's doing, but she loved country music. And yeah, that was the first time ever on stage. And just to watch music resonate with people, it's definitely what lit the flame for me.
And so you've been singing since you were tiny. Really, seven is really young. You went to summer camp at Interlochen.
Yeah.
And how did that affect you?
Well, and that was at 9 years old. So I will tell you, I was so scared. It was the first time I'd ever been away from home, and especially doing something like this and at a camp that was as prestigious as Interlochen. And I was really nervous. And I remember my mom dropped me off, and the first day I met some of the best people I could have ever asked for and some of the best girls in community. And that summer really changed my perspective on music, and especially knowing one of my favorite artists is Jewel, and knowing that she had attended Interlochen, and it was just really inspiring for me and really changed my perspective and direction in just wanting to pursue music. I definitely had that drive after attending Interlochen.
And little did you know when you were 9 years old that years later you would nail your blind audition for The Voice by singing Jewel's song, You Were Meant for Me.
I know. It's another thing, that one of those pinch me moments in being able to have a response from her too. She tweeted at me after congratulating, and I couldn't believe, you know, being up there and being able to share a song like You Were Meant for Me by Jewel was just really special for me. The message and being able to have my own twist on it, it was just such a gift. And I think it really resonated with the coaches. But I really had no idea what to expect. So just really thankful that that song worked.
I hear the clock, it's 6 a.m. I feel so far from where I've been. Wife, the spots upon the mirror. Leave the keys in the door. I never pull the towels on the floor anymore.
Okay, 5 seconds.
Oh, thank you.
Oh my God. Even after you're gone, and I know that you love me, and soon you'll see. You and I.
Well, it did, because didn't all the chairs turn around for you?
Everyone besides Alicia.
Okay.
Which, you know what? It was okay, because I was so thankful to at least have one to start with. But, yeah, Alicia was tricky, and it's funny. She came up to me after, and she's like, I was actually the second audition out of 123 people. She's like, I can't be wasting my chairs on these first two auditions. I'm like, girl, it's okay.
I totally
understand, Alicia Keys. You can do whatever you want.
Well, we're actually getting ahead of ourselves, because back to when you were making career choices, you did not go to school for music and performing arts.
No. You know, it's funny, because I had the choice. I actually wanted to attend Interlochen for high school and chose not to for a number of reasons. I knew I wanted to pursue dentistry, but in the back of my mind, I knew music was in my heart, but was always, you know, a little self-conscious and not really confident enough to chase after it. So I chose to go to the University of Michigan and pursue dentistry. And right around my senior year, a few things happened where there was just these little signs, and I don't know where they were coming from, but something telling me, you know what, you better give this a shot, because if you don't, you're going to regret it. And so I did, and I moved to Chicago for a couple months after graduating from U of M and started running after music, and I'm so glad I did. It led me to Nashville a few months later, and that was 4.5 years ago, which is crazy to think about, but yeah.
Now, when you were in Nashville, you stop and you think, talk about a town with a heck of a lot of talent, both in songwriting and performing, and you were saying you had some confidence issues.
I did, and you know, it's funny, because I moved there, and the city was so inspiring for me. I would go with a couple of my friends to these writer rounds, and I would watch these famous songwriters perform hits, and I would immediately go home and be like, okay, we've got to write tonight, whether it was midnight or in the morning. And I was writing a lot, but at the same time, so insecure to be performing in that town. And I couldn't figure out why. And I really didn't even know until I blinked and 3 years had gone by and I hadn't performed once in Nashville. And I really do blame myself for that. And I look back and I don't have any serious regrets, but I do wish I would have kind of, you know, believed in myself a little bit earlier on. But I'm so thankful, you know, regardless, that The Voice kind of pushed me to be confident in myself again, you know.
And the voice called you right after seeing you on Instagram.
Yeah. Yeah, they direct messaged me on Instagram, and it was the most bizarre thing. It was actually, talk about signs, the same week I called my mom. I was caretaking for a friend of mine with ALS, and I called her and I said, "Mom, I think I'm going to move home and I'm going to start applying for dental school." And she's like, "Honey, I respect that. You do whatever you want, and I love you regardless." But that same week, I got the message a few days later from The Voice, and I thought it was a joke, you know, and I'm like, why would they direct message me on Instagram? But, you know, after digging for some more info and my dad also doing some research, because he's like, "There's no way you're going down to Atlanta and auditioning in a warehouse. That sounds really safe.
Sketch."
Yep. You know, after that, I remember being at the audition and, yeah, blinking and being on the finale stage, it was crazy.
So that process of being on The Voice, Lauren Dusky, and working with Blake Shelton and putting yourself out there every week for America to vote on you. And when I watch the clips to remind myself of your time on The Voice, I don't see that young woman who was insecure in Nashville. Did you feel scared, or did it feel like you were home on that stage?
In the beginning, the first few performances were pretty terrifying, but then, you know, I love to perform and get lost in the story of the song. And really, that's what happens pretty much every time I'm up there. So I don't have much time to think. And especially in a situation like The Voice, where there are cameras everywhere and they're counting down, like going live in 5. And you're like, well, here we go. But I was so thankful for that opportunity, because it really pushed me to realize why I'm doing this. And why I love music so much, and specifically performing for people, because you can see it. You can see it resonating, and I do find a lot of clarity myself when I'm up there singing, whether it's my own music or covers. So I don't really get too scared anymore. There are certain situations where I'll get a little sweaty and nervous, but not many.
And here you are back home in Michigan for these dates, the Intersection in Grand Rapids on Thursday and Alpenfest in Gaylord on Friday night. Are you having kind of a Lauren Dusky, this is your life moment here?
Yeah, it's been wild, and especially to be back home. And I haven't had a chance to really share this journey with my home state in person, you know, because I was out in LA for about a year. And then for the last few months to a year, I've been spending full time in Nashville writing and recording this new record and the single, which I'm really excited about. So to be home, it's really the first time. And I get to meet everyone, and especially see some familiar faces. It's been really exciting for me to share this with everyone. And I kind of underestimated and have been so humbled by the support and love from Northern Michigan, and specifically my hometown. It's definitely overwhelming in the best way.
And you have an album coming out later this year, but your single Costume Party drops this week. Let's take a listen.
I've got this closet filled with ways for you to see me, but none of them fit me. And I walk around and play pretend so you'll believe that I'm who I wanna be. But what if I let you see who I am? Was it so damn hard not to give a damn? And what if I could show my flaws and not be sorry? 'Cause I'm over this whole costume party. And I can't seem to remember what it is I'm so afraid of.
I'm really excited about this body of work, and I've been writing my butt off, trying to find songs that I'm really proud of and that really represent me as an artist and as a young woman. So I'm really excited about this.
As an artist, what's the story that you most want to tell through the songs you're writing, the songs you're choosing and putting on this album?
You know, it's a great question. I didn't know for the longest time what I wanted to say or who I wanted to be as an artist. And especially in Nashville, you kind of get lost in it for a while. I definitely did. And I remember after writing Costume Party last year around Thanksgiving, finally having that aha moment where it really took digging into some deeper insecurities and realizing that I'm not okay all the time, and that's perfectly fine because I know I'm not alone in this, and I want people to know that they're not alone and everyone's going through something, whether we realize it or not or want to acknowledge it. I think just letting people know that wherever you are, whoever you are, it's perfectly fine the way you are, and no one's perfect. I am surely not perfect, and I'm going to always be a work in progress, but knowing that you are perfectly fine being yourself. I think that is the one message that I want people to hear and really believe and live by, because I have to remind myself every day, especially in this industry, that's you're kind of pulled in different directions and trying to figure out who you want to be. And regardless of what happens, I'm just so thankful to finally be sharing music full time. And I can't thank you enough for the support. Truly, it means more than you know.
Lauren Dusky, enjoy being back in Michigan singing Thursday in Grand Rapids at the Intersection and Alpenfest Friday night in Gaylord. It was great talking with you.
It was such a pleasure.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.
I'm stepping out of my own way, out of this masquerade.
Coming up, what do baseball, movies, trains, drinking, and shopping have in common? Well, attempts were once made to legally ban them from happening on Sundays. Plus, as we consider legalizing recreational marijuana in Michigan, that could mean more impaired drivers on the road. What's the best way to test someone who's driving under the influence of cannabis? We'll talk with a researcher working on that very question. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is Wednesday, and that's time to talk our state's history.
I've sent the following wire to President Truman. My heartiest congratulations to you on your election.
I'm aware of my blackness, but I don't go around and look and see whether I'm different than someone else.
Fail a lot quickly, and then eventually you'll succeed.
I worry that the person who thought up Muzak may be thinking up something else.
In our current age of instant access media and nonstop consumerism, it's kind of hard to believe that only 50 years ago, Michigan had a law banning most businesses from being open on Sunday. The law, which was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1962, fell into the category of blue laws. Here now to give a more detailed explanation is the Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark. Rachel, welcome back.
Thank you.
So let us cut right to the chase. Exactly what are blue laws?
Blue laws are, or were, laws that were set out to regulate behavior on the Sabbath, or the first day of the week, which Michigan law determined that the first day of the week would be Sunday or the Sabbath. That's the language of the law.
And were the laws that were trying to regulate behavior on a Sunday, have they been around since Michigan gained statehood in 1837, or did these kind of develop and build ahead of steam over time?
Some of the early laws actually started as early as 1820 during Michigan's territorial days. So in 1820, an act made, as I said, Sunday the first day of the week. It will be observed as the Sabbath, holy day, or a day of rest. So there is that stipulation within that 1820 act, and it's a rest from all secular labor. It also stated there won't be any games, any sports, any play, no public assembly. It actually listed out the expectations of that Sabbath or first day of the week.
What groups were behind the push for these blue laws and why?
They were traditionally religious groups. So early on, it was mostly Presbyterian groups that were sort of trying to regulate behavior on the Sabbath, especially things like going out for Sunday travel or any pretty much anything fun or entertaining. And then later the Methodists get involved in it. In the early 20th century, the Women's Christian Temperance Union also starts chiming in on their expectations for Sunday. And then as movies become popular, Baptists begin chiming in. So.
And what was the deal with movies? Just it was
movies,
fun?
It was seen as a waste of a Sunday. So they were seeing that the enrollment or the attendance of younger people at church was dropping and that the attendance of younger people at movies was increasing. And so they put the two together and blamed films on the drop in Sunday church going by younger people. Plus, anything in a movie was seen as just inappropriate, no matter what the movie was.
Kind of going through, especially the 19th century into the early 20th century, what were people supposed to be doing if they weren't working in the fields or they weren't, you know, behind their store counters or out even on a Sunday drive? What were you supposed to be doing?
The expectation was that you would observe the Sabbath, and that changes depending on what faith you were. So most people would then go to a church service, and those lasted however long, again, depending on the type of faith. But then anything to do with religion. So if you wanted to go to a lecture, you could. It just had to be about faith and religion. So Bible studies and things of that nature, those were okay. Later on, as things begin to develop with the Sunday laws, the expectation was also that you simply rest, that you do not work. So anything that was deemed secular would be off limits. You couldn't do it. So those were the two things that were sort of expected for those Sundays.
I'm wondering about a nap. That would be considered secular or rest.
I know. I guess it depends on what you dream about.
What about having a tipple on Sundays, pouring a glass of something alcoholic?
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not. So those laws, that alcohol prohibition, that got a lot of attention. Give us some other Sunday activities the blue laws tried to regulate as we go through the years.
So the attempted regulations went into things like social visits. So the expectation was that you would stay at home. Pleasure drives, not only in buggies, but later on as people start to buy cars. So those Sunday drivers that people see, that was not appreciated. So musical entertainment of any kind, secular lectures of any kind. In the 1880s and 1890s, you start to see complaints about military encampments, which would at that point probably be reunions, Civil War reunions. And so those were seen as not okay for a Sunday. Sunday baseball became a huge problem in the 1860s. There are letters in the archives of Michigan from places up north, and people are complaining that the teams just won't stop playing on Sunday. They still are meeting, and they write the governor asking for help. And of course, the governor is not going to really chime in on that. Even trains. Some towns want trains to not come through on Sundays. And then finally, newspapers. And, you know, when I was a kid, I remember the Sunday edition of the newspaper was enormous. It was fat. It had the comics. It had all the advertisements.
The magazine sections. Yes.
Oh, yeah. Sunday newspapers were seen as a problem. And so all of those things there were attempts to regulate those on Sundays. A lot of them fell by the wayside, though, because what they realized was Sunday was actually a day that a lot of businesses got things done. A lot of shipping was actually done on Sundays. Taking Sunday out of a shipping rotation really sort of messed up supply for various businesses. So some of those laws, once people started really looking at them, these groups backed off of trying to regulate those. But the thing that really everybody sort of backed on was state and county fairs. That brought the Baptists, Presbyterians, and Methodists together. They all agreed state and county fairs on Sunday were an absolute no-no.
Interesting. Well, what about consequences? Were there legal punishments if Eaton County had a fair and it was on a Sunday? I'm just picking Eaton County randomly, nothing in history, but would there be legal consequences?
Legal, not so much. Early on in that 1820 Act, and then later on through the 19th century, the laws would indicate fines anywhere from $2 to $5, depending on what the issue is. So there were fines that were listed as possible consequences, but it was really difficult to regulate this, and it was really difficult to collect on any of that. So there were consequences listed on the books, but consequences in reality were sort of few and far between. That's why the baseball team could sort of ignore the requests
and keep
still play
playing.
Baseball.
These rules do seem stringent, but these blue laws were held to be constitutional?
They were. The morality laws for religious purposes were determined to be unconstitutional. So you can have Sunday laws, which are these blue laws. Those were deemed constitutional as long as they are secular in purpose. As you start to get these labor movements in the late 19th and early 20th century, and unions are attempting to shorten the work days, shorten the work week, these laws come in that allow Sunday to be a day off in terms of work. That was deemed constitutional because it is secular in nature. But the ones that were deemed religious in nature, those couldn't be upheld in court. And so as long as it was not a religiously based reason for closing, then you could do it.
What happened to these blue laws? And are any still on the books in our state?
Most of them just sort of died away. As I said, some of them were really hard to regulate. Some of them were hard to enforce. Individual businesses can now decide if they stay open or not on Sundays. But liquor sales were the ones that really sort of held on the longest. So the state of Michigan changed its liquor laws in 2010, allowing for early Sunday liquor sales. It used to be everything was closed on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And then it used to be things could open at noon. And then in terms of liquor sales, it was no liquor sales on Sunday and then liquor sales afternoon. And finally, a few years ago, they said, if you want to sell alcohol Sunday mornings, you can. But different counties can opt out of that. And so that is still left to local governments to determine if they want to do that.
The Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark. Thank you, Rachel, for giving us the lowdown on Michigan's blue laws.
Thank you very much.
Canada has said yes to legal recreational marijuana. October 17th is when our Canadian neighbors can legally get high on cannabis. And on November 6th, Michiganders will vote on whether or not to legalize recreational marijuana. All of which raises a vital question: how to best identify buzzed driving. Dr. Andrea Furlan has been digging into that very question. She's a staff physician and senior scientist at the Toronto Rehabilitation Institute and an associate professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of Toronto. Doctor, you've got the most advanced driving simulator in Canada at Toronto Rehab. Tell us about this IDAPT driver lab.
Yes, it's an underground complete driving simulator. It's an auditory in a 300-degree dome that we put this car in an immersive virtual reality, and the driver inside this car has a complete field of view, a 360-degree projection system. We can actually simulate real rain with water splashing on the windshield. We can simulate rural, urban scenarios. We can simulate a day and night. And the participants said to us that this is very realistic. It's almost like a driving on road.
So what are some of the major research questions that you and your team are looking into through working in this IDAPT driver lab?
Yes, because this driver lab is in the basement of our hospital, Toronto Rehab, we have the opportunity to recruit a lot of patients and people who have cognitive impairment. One of the focus of our main research is looking at seniors and what is safe for them to drive, because we want to keep them driving as long as possible. The other big area of research will be the effects of drugs like opioids, antidepressants, sleeping pills, and of course cannabis, which is the topic of the day, especially with a lot of our patients using medical marijuana and also those who are going to use for recreational purposes.
Now, Dr. Furlan, I understand that not all impaired driving is created equal. Tell us, what are the major differences between driving while drunk and driving while high?
When people use alcohol, the effects on the brain are different from cannabis. The alcohol affects the judgment first. The first thing that goes is the ability to realize that a person is doing silly things, is acting like stupid. That's called the judgment. It's right in the frontal lobe of the brain. Alcohol impairs that. Cannabis does not, which is interesting because when people are under the influence of cannabis, they still know they are conscious about the impairments. So there is an opportunity for the person using cannabis to self-regulate, to determine if this is safe or not to do. Unfortunately, a lot of people who use cannabis for recreational purposes, like a party, on a weekend, they use both cannabis and alcohol. Different from our patients who use medical marijuana for medicinal purposes, they avoid alcohol. They know that this is not a good mixture. So if they use alcohol and cannabis together, they will be impaired by the alcohol, but also different areas of the brain will be impaired by cannabis, and they will be much more impaired than only one substance.
How do you feel when you watch these folks in the driver lab and in your simulator? How do the differences between alcohol and cannabis, how do they show up in driving styles?
Usually people under the influence of alcohol, they drive faster. they get much closer to the car in front of them. They also do a lot of maneuvers that are not safe. And of course, they are more sleepy or the attention is reduced. People under the influence of cannabis, they tend to drive slower. And that's not because they are driving safer. It's because the reaction time is much impaired. So they take many more seconds compared to a person that is not impaired by cannabis to react to a stimulus in front of them. People under the influence of cannabis, they're not only driving slower, they also have a distorted perception of time and distorted perception of space. The brain is giving that information that is not totally accurate. That's why they probably keep a longer distance. But if something happens in front of them and they need to react to some stimulus in front of them, they will not react fast enough. And that's when they may get into trouble. On the other hand, we also know that depending on how much THC, THC is a substance in the cannabis plant that causes the euphoria, the high, the higher the substance in the brain, more euphoric they get, and they may be taking risks. They may be doing more maneuvers that are unsafe just because they think that they have superpowers or they can do those things and nothing will happen to them.
If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with Dr. Andrea Furlan, who is with the Toronto Rehabilitation Institute and also the Department of Medicine at the University of Toronto, as we talk about figuring out and controlling buzzed driving as we see more and more states and certainly Canada getting on board with legal recreational marijuana. What about policing? How do the accepted roadside tests that we've seen for drunk driving, how do they do for police in identifying buzz driving?
Yeah, this is a new field for police because it's not the same thing as testing alcohol. There is no equivalent of the blood alcohol concentration. Like everybody knows, if there is more than 0.08% in the blood, you are impaired. There's no equivalent in the cannabis because people develop tolerance to the effect of cannabis, the THC. Like our patients who use THC regularly, daily for many years, the body develops this tolerance and the psychotropic effects are not observed anymore. So, but they will still be tested positive in the saliva or blood or urine. The other problem is also some people may use like a cannabis, they may smoke a joint in the weekend, but they may test positive on Monday morning when they go to work or when they're driving because that substance can stay in the body for days. So testing body fluids is not the best approach. On the other hand, police enforcers, they started using the same, you know, the tests that they use when that someone is drunk, like the field sobriety test, that they have to walk in a straight line, they have to stand in one leg, they observe the eye movements. That is still not validated for the effects of cannabis because cannabis affects the brain differently. It's not the same functions that alcohol does. So we still need to do a lot of research to validate what are the roadside tests that detect impairment. I really believe, and our group is trying to develop some behavioral tests, things that we could look in a screen of a computer. They do some tests in the computer or a tablet, or even in the future, what I think will happen in the future, we'll be able to install in the car, like a screen that the person will have to do some tests, and that will be able to detect if they are impaired by any drug, not only cannabis, but could be able to detect alcohol, antidepressants, opioids, and if they don't pass the test, the car will not even start. That will be our dream in the future.
Bottom line, doctor, how long do you think someone should wait after they have used cannabis until they drive or they work in a safety-sensitive job?
If they smoked or vaporized forms, which go much faster to the brain, we recommend them to wait 6 hours just to be safe after they use the last joint. Wait for 6 hours. Some people are less, some people are more, but to be safe, we tell 6. If they use an edible form, like an ingested oil or brownie, or they eat the leaves or a tea, we tell them to wait 10 and sometimes 12 hours. We're going to use the driver lab in our hospital to test exactly this. How long is it safe? What is exactly the period? And because it depends on so many variables, how much THC it has in the substance, it depends if the person is already tolerant or not, It depends if they're using for medical purposes that has more CBD than THC. So there are many variables in the system, and we hope to find those answers soon.
Dr. Andrea Furlan, who's with the University of Toronto Department of Medicine and the Toronto Rehabilitation Institute. Doctor, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Cindy.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Bob Scott. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Sam Corey, Gabrielle Horton, Sophie Sherry, and April Van Buren. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.